Throughout the centuries, Dersingham has not been a stranger to conflict. The villagers of the 17th century were caught up in the events of the Civil War, and there is a document dated 1807 stating that 30 Dersingham men were liable to be enlisted for service in the Napoleonic Wars. It is even recorded that £6, 16 shillings and sixpence was collected by the villagers for the relief and benefit of the brave men killed and the wounded sufferers in the Battle of Waterloo. A parish magazine lists the men of Dersingham who served in the Boer War: Jack Coe, Walter Dibble, James Grief, Albert Flegg, and Harry and Thomas Riches are a few, names still familiar in the village today. Harry Riches was the first to be invalided home, and later Gunner Sidney Rainbow, also invalided home, helped out by teaching the schoolchildren military drill on the school playground. There are many references to the First World War. The first attack by a Zeppelin was in this area when one flew over Hunstanton, dropped bombs at Snettisham, and went on to drop more bombs at King's Lynn, causing much damage and loss of life. A later Zeppelin dropped two bombs on Dersingham, causing damage to a cottage at the top of Dodds Hill and the loss of one life.
Cliff Riches and Eddie Roy have vivid memories of this Zeppelin raid.
The First War, I remember the Zeppelin raids very well.
What, round here?
I'm talking about the First World War now.
Yes.
At the shop. I suppose about 1916 they'd probably started.
So how old would you have been then?
Oh, four.
And you can remember.
But I can remember that ever so well, because you got to remember that that was something. When they dropped bombs, it impressed itself on a child's mind.
Of course.
And my mother used to take us all in the pantry, in the larder. Of course, it was under the stairs, and they always thought that was the strongest part. But I remember this night, and I can tell you exactly where the bombs dropped. It came, the Zeppelin came over our house from the seaside, and the first bomb fell. Do you know where Wellsville House is? In Manor Road.
Right.
It's now Manor Side.
Yes.
Well, that used to be a field. The first bomb dropped there, the crater there, and then the next one dropped in the open common, you know, where they've been doing all this...
Yes, getting rid of all the
but
rubbish.
But where they haven't done it, it was the bomb crater was there. We used to go and find bits of shrapnel, you know. And then, luckily, it went on and dropped all the rest of its load on the fence.
Yes.
And then one bomb didn't go off, and I remember the next day... I was only a small lad. Dad kept a few chickens, you see, and it was in the war. And I went up to the baker's shop, which was opposite the White Horse, Jarvis, and to get some corn for his chickens. And they hadn't told people, or at least we didn't know. This bomb went off. I remember dropping the bag of corn over the road, you know, running.
Right.
We were terrified.
Because
I killed a woman that night.
Really?
Dodsell. You know where the square is at Dodson, the green?
Yes.
If you can still see some shrapnel marks from one of the bombs on a chimney. If you look across, if you come up from the bottom of the hill and you come to the green, there's some houses that way on, and then there's some like that, isn't there? And up there you can see that.
See
still.
More.
But this woman... she was caught outside and she was killed. A lady by the name of Dunga, Mrs. Dunga.
Oh.
And I remember my parents taking us up the next day, and some old boy had got a collecting box, was sitting in the bomb crater, collecting money for the bomb people. But two or three times we had the raids like that.
Yes, I suppose most
and
of it.
Actually, I saw one of them with a searchlight on it one night. Like a cigar, my father carried me out in his arms.
The worst thing I remember was around about 1916-1917, we heard on a Sunday morning, we lived living in Great Masham, we heard on the Sunday morning, how I don't know, that the Zeppelins had dropped three bombs at Dodds Hill, and the gable end of my aunt's house had blown out through the concussion of the bombs.
This was your aunt's house,
yes,
on Dodd's Hill?
Yes, Dodd's Hill.
Good gracious.
Yes. And two bombs dropped in the garden, and one dropped on that little piece of green. If you... of Dodd's Hill, it's a little
right
piece
at the
of
top.
Green. And
the,
yeah, no, yeah. Not right at the top.
Oh.
Middle way.
Right.
And three rows of cards stand back. Father got to know, somehow or another, and so he brought me, I was at 7 or 8, you see, he brought me over on the Sunday morning to see the damage and see if his sister was all right, you see.
Yeah.
And that was what we found. And that was the worst moments of my...
Yes.
Indeed.
Was your aunt all right?
Yeah, they was all right. And, when we looked in that cable, then there was the bed there.
and the wall had all come out.
You see.
Now, whose responsibility to repair it? Was it the wall?
Sandham House. Well, no, all that property up there belongs to Sandham Estate.
Right.
So that I can't tell
so
you.
So your aunt would have been moved out, and Sandham would have paid to.
Yes, she moved to some cottages opposite the video shop. In the village,
yes.
Now there was 3 cottages there, and one was empty, and she was moved there till her house was repaired.
So there wasn't a lot of damage through the war to this village, was there?
As far as I know, that was the only thing.
Yes.
And that wasn't bad because I wasn't direct hit.
One soldier returned to Dursingham after this conflict and lived for a time in a pumping station in Sandringham Woods. Now, with hindsight, it is obvious he was probably suffering from shell shock.
Bill Playford, whose grandfather ran the bakery in Manor Road at this time, recalls an incident involving this unfortunate soldier.
Oh, the old boys who had come back from the First World War, there was one, what was his name, Arthur Dowdy, stood on the letterbox corner where the BMW cars are now. There was a letterbox on that corner. And he stood there all day, clapping his hands, trying to keep warm, until one day, well, he lived in the pumping station, which was up in the woods, which pumped the water from Wolferton and Sandringham and Westnett. He lived in there. Nobody interfered with him, and he didn't interfere with very many people.
And you say he'd been in the First World War, right?
And the police were suspicious, and Grandfather was suspicious of him because every now and again there'd be a loaf of bread missing. So one day a policeman in plain clothes stood and they was waiting for him, and he did. He went up to the cart and nicked a loaf of bread and they had him. But he was harmless.
Was he suffering from shell shock, basically?
Yeah, poor old boy.
As a little boy, Sidney Mitchell remembers the return of his father from Gallipoli.
My memory takes me back to immediately after the First World War, the return of my father from the war.
And you would have been how old then?
5 or 6 years old.
Right, yes.
This would be in the early 20s.
And your father was away fighting?
My father had been away and had been a member of the Sandringham Company of the 5th Norfolks, and had served with them in Gallipoli, but fortunately he was wounded on landing and he got home. There were many that did not come back, and there's still speculation as to what happened to them.
Ah, and this is a photograph of your father.
That's my father.
Ah. When he returned?
That would have been during his service in the war. He was then a military policeman.
And he looks very young.
Well, they were quite young in those days.
Yes.
I think he was wounded, and so this is what they used to do with many of them. They would become military policemen.
Yes.
We have only to look at the village war memorial, the altar in the church, and several gravestones in the churchyard to read the names of those men who served in the Great War of 1914 and in the Second World War, many of whom paid the ultimate price. Just inside the gate of the churchyard is the grave belonging to Wesley Tuck, who served in the Norfolk Regiment and died in October 1916. On the gravestone is the name of his brother Hubert, who served with the Canadians and died the month before. 43 Dersingham men lost their lives in that conflict. The memorial also commemorates 19 men who lost their lives in the Second World War. There are 204 names on the memorial of men honoured for their service overseas and of 44 who served here in the Home Guard. In the churchyard there are the graves of a private killed by enemy aircraft on Massingham petrol dump, a London policeman killed on duty during an air raid, a flying officer killed on active service aged only 19, and another grave shows one who died a prisoner of war in Japan.
Dick Stanton can remember the effect that the fear of invasion had on his mother and father, while Elizabeth Neal remembers the day her father left.
I think my first memory was being on a field with my father and mother, a very hot day in 1940, and we were actually burning twitch, which is kutchbrush. You couldn't spread it in those days, you just had to drag it up and burn it. My sister and I loved going to burn and playing with matches. And I remember all that afternoon, my father and mother kept saying to us, you know, we just hope the Germans don't come, but they're not far away. And I can always remember them being, my father wasn't a miserable person, but he was very upset that afternoon.
I suppose, again, remembering when my father had to go off to war, and I can remember quite vividly walking down Station Road with Mum, and I was very young, only four, but I can remember thinking it was very sad, and I didn't know when I'd see my father again.
And presumably your mum was upset.
Yes, but no.
Oh.
No, she didn't show. I can't remember her crying, but I guess she probably did. But so, you know, people in those days, I think they didn't show their emotions to children. I can't remember all through the war when things must have been really bad, and I know my father was missing, or we didn't know what had happened to him for over 3 months. But I can never remember being scared. She used to say it would be all right, you know. And I think people put on a very brave face.
War was declared on September the 3rd, 1939, and the village was immediately affected. The school logbook records on September the 11th that the school opened with evacuees attending.
Here is Elizabeth Neal again with her memories of the evacuees.
And then we had all the excitement of the evacuees coming.
Oh.
Which sort of took it off in a way, because we had to have an evacuee and I was an only child, so to have this child staying with us, we were like sisters, really. I mean, she was awful when she came. She really was, and from the East End of London and came from a terrible background. But, you know, Mother was so patient with her. And I can remember, you know, when she did eventually go home, that it was a very sad day to see her go.
Did the evacuees... Were you at school when this happened?
Yes.
So
yes,
did the evacuees come to school?
Oh, yes. Oh, we were packed out at school. In one of my school reports, numbering class 63.
Good gracious.
We were all in that little school there.
So how did the evacuees fit in with the school children, do you think?
It's difficult to say, because I was only sort of 5 till about 8. Most of them settled in quite well. But looking back on it, how strict the teachers were in those days. There was no emotion or feeling, or it didn't seem to come over that way. I can remember the little boy, and he used to come back to the village, and I better not say his full name, but his Christian name was Billy. And poor little Mike, he used to wet himself because he was frightened, you know, and if an aircraft went over, he would be terribly scared. But he would get in awful trouble at school, and the teacher would never let him go to the toilet because he wanted to go, you know. But it would, you didn't go to the toilet in class time.
Because there's no doubt,
with modern teaching methods, you could not cope with 60 children in a classroom.
No, no.
You could only cope with it because so they were all sitting in tables facing the
front. Yes, well, we had those double desks, and once you were in, you were in. I mean, you just literally, physically, couldn't get out because you were in a long line. There'd be perhaps 10 in the line because there'd be 5 desks, you know, those old-fashioned desks with the seats that tipped up. And once you were in until playtime, you know, and you all came out at the same time. You didn't ever leave your desk.
No, because you've worked in schools yourself, you kind of seen the difference.
Oh, yes.
Now, I mean, for instance, the teacher couldn't possibly ever get round the room.
No.
So
no, she was in the front.
So what did she teach all day? Well, you just had the one teacher, presumably.
Yes, yes.
So what did she...
Well, I suppose we had a bit as they're going back to now. You had what we might call a literacy hour and a maths hour. That was the morning done. Then the afternoon, when you got into the big classroom, which was Mrs. Barker, who died not too long ago, she took the big class, and we would be in there, and we had to knit socks for the soldiers. And I can remember we had these sets of 4 needles, little steel needles, size 14 they were, and I can see it now in her best copper plate writing on the wall, how to turn the heel. And we had to do 4.5 inches of knit 2, purl 2 ribbing. Can you remember that?
And did the boys knit?
Boys were knitting as well, and they had to do quite a lot of work on the garden when the girls were doing needlework, but they were taught to knit. The boys could knit, but they didn't have to do the socks for the soldiers, I don't think, but they definitely had to work in the garden, on the vegetable garden. And then those vegetables were used, you see, and there were chickens kept there as well for eggs on the garden at the back.
So you were being taught useful things you would have done when you...
Yes, it was... But they were happy days, strangely enough.
The school logbook also records the visits of the gas van, which would arrive in the school playground, and all the children had to walk through it with their gas masks to have them tested. The arrival of syrup pumps is recorded, and the visit of Superintendent Wooderson, the local police officer, who came to demonstrate anti-personnel bombs and to warn the children of them and all the dangers they were to look out for.
Alan Cross, Edie Gilson with her friend, and Geoffrey Rolfe could remember these events at school.
I suppose the schooling probably was, although you, as children, you don't realise it at the time. It's only looking back that you realise how things are affected. I think probably the schooling made a great deal of difference because the schooling was quite poor at the time. One has to remember that many of the younger teachers had been called up, and sport was completely out as far as the school was concerned. So I think in many ways it was they were very poor years as far as schooling was concerned.
Were they having just temporary teachers, you mean?
Some were temporary teachers. Some were very good teachers, though. I remember in particular Miss Boyce and Miss Robinson. Miss Boyce became Miss Cook, I beg your pardon, Miss Cook was her original name. She married and became Mrs. Boyce and later became Mrs. Barker. She was a very good teacher and she was strict but respected. And Miss Robinson was also a very good teacher. She took the children in earlier years. She was very good, also respected. I think the further you got along in school, the poorer became the teachers, or at least that's how we found it. And respect went for the teachers to some extent, and learning wasn't emphasised enough.
Do you think you had lost a lot of the men teachers, which were mainly replaced by women teachers?
That's right, that tended to be the case.
And that's why there wasn't the sport anymore, probably.
I think, well, the sport wasn't allowed. We weren't allowed to go onto the pastures to play sport at all. I suppose to some extent this may have been because of the possibility of air raids and this kind of thing, because there had been trenches dug in the school gardens and on the emblems, which were where, if there was an air raid, we had to evacuate too.
So in school you had to be prepared at any time for a raid?
We had to be prepared. We had to take our gas masks everywhere we went. We carried our little boxes with a gas mask in it. Yeah, that was standard practice then.
Would you say, looking back, that you were frightened? Or didn't it bother you?
Well, we weren't bothered at all. To some extent, as children, I mean, we didn't realise what others in other places were going through, but to us, the military activity that was going on around here, because there were troops, thousands of troops manoeuvring around here from time to time, and to us that was wonderful entertainment to be able to associate ourselves with them as best we could.
So I suppose all the little boys wanted to go in the army themselves.
Well, some of them did, but we again around the common area where the troops used to use for manoeuvres a lot, if we could find a few thunder flashes that hadn't gone off when they'd been using them, it was our pride and joy then.
I panicked a bit. I remember when I was a little girl, I panicked when we first had to wear the gas masks. Oh. And I was worried about my mother and father, because my father said, well, I'm not going to wear one. And I remember when I was at school, I was ever so worried, you know, because he said he wouldn't wear one, and you know, we were expecting to be gassed, I suppose.
Yes. Can you remember when we lived next door to you, when my mother heard the church bells and said it was gas?
Yes.
And got us all out of bed.
Yeah.
And that was a false alarm. My mother said, oh, the church bells are ringing, that's gas. And she got us all up in the row, didn't she? I think old Lady Richards and everybody. My mother made a mistake. She put, you know, she said, oh, that's gas, and we all had to get up.
Now, did your parents think you were going to be gassed by gas bombs or something? I mean, where was the gas coming from?
Yes, I suppose gas bombs, yes, that would be, wouldn't it?
And you'd all been taught how to wear these
things?
Yes,
oh, yes, we had a practice, you know, we had to wear these gas masks, yes.
Up at the top, and during the wartime we used to have gas masks on, and we used to have to go up to the top there and go down into the trenches. Because they said that if ever there was an air raid or a threat of war, we would have to go up the top like going down into trenches for shelter. And they were dug directly behind the school on the emblems.
Really? And they were dug, were they specially for the school children?
For the school children, yes.
And did you used to have to take the gas masks to school?
Yes, you carried that all with you all the time, like a satchel.
And presumably practiced everything.
Well, there was times when they did make you go through a little gas chamber. They brought a mobile thing at the school and you walked through it and tested your gas mask. But you never went without. Another thing I did mention to the boss, I don't know if anybody know about it in the field, but when I was a young boy, up the road here was a searchlight.
Somebody has mentioned it before, somebody who lived along here, yes. Well, was it to do with the war?
It was to do with the war.
Right.
And there is a little bit of the footing still left, and the field is now called Searchlight High Field.
And we're talking about, for people listening, the top of Dodds Hill?
Yes, on the Linghouse Road.
Right.
And as children we were very interested in that, because that was such a powerful light, and that was... at night, searching the sky for enemy aeroplanes.
On January the 5th, 1942, the school log records that water was laid onto the school. This is among Bill Playford's memories.
They used to take us for nature study walks up the woods, you know, up Sandringham Woods. But we were, half the day, we were digging trenches on the elements, you know, in case of an air raid or anything like that.
Right. Now, apart from school, is there anything else you can remember from when you were a little boy?
Not a lot, because we just went to school and came home. Well, they laid the water on when we were at school. Doc and Bristol District Council did. Because...
So there was no mains water then?
No. Not till they laid it on. From well, docking, I suppose it came from the reservoir at the docking. And we used to jump in and out the trenches when we were kids. Mother bought us a pair of overalls because we made other clothes so dirty.
So you're saying there was no piped water?
No.
So where did...
And the first piped water they had were standpipes, which were on concrete posts, and just a tap where people had to go and draw the water off.
The whole community in Dursingham were all actively involved in one way or another in the war effort. Mr. Linford and Mr. Tuck were appointed the village's first wardens. Others soon joined, and after 1940, Mr. Lloyd Pratt of the Oaks was the leader, and a warden's post was established at his house. The present-day doctor's surgery and housing now occupy the site of this large house with lovely gardens, which was sadly burnt down in 1965. Other warden's posts were established at the Feathers and at Mr. Linford's house, the present-day hot food takeaway at the crossroads. Dursingham had an efficient casualty service with trained stretcher-bearers. There was a first aid post at the Feathers and later also at the Dun Cow pub. There were many lectures and exercises. Special constables cooperated with the civil defence, enforcing blackouts, looking for parachutists. All were trained to deal with air incidents or gas attacks. Other villagers became canteen workers and savings collectors. Others worked on the farms and at the flax factory in West Newton.
Many of the young men joined the local defence volunteers. One of them was Peter Reynolds.
Oh, the local defence volunteer thing, yes. So when the war broke out, I was what? Rising 17. Everyone rushed to do something, and I joined civil defence for a while. And I was a sort of messenger whizzing around on a bicycle if needed. And then, after all that Dunkirk time, there was the call for the local defence volunteers, and so I jumped into that. One had an armband that said LDV and no uniform, and he didn't have rifles, sort of walking stick or whatever. And he used to have a shepherd's hut up on the Mill Road, beyond Mill Road, beyond the Mill House, and on the road that led to Inglethorpe, between Mill House and Inglethorpe Chalk Pit. Had a shepherd's hut there, and we were supposed to watch out for parachutists or anything going on, whatever. Nothing ever happened except we used to pitch and I'd bird out of the hedgerow. And then eventually that got transferred into becoming the Home Guard. So I became in that, and then until I joined, I volunteered for the Air Force and went away. And I was away for. I suppose I did come home on leave once in the first year in the Air Force, and then I went abroad without coming home on leave. I was away for 4 years or so before I came back. So came back in 45, I suppose, posted down to Suffolk, and had a very cushy number down there. There were six of us on an Air Force transmitter station at an Air Force base, doing the work of about three, because of the tail end of the war.
Right.
I think the panics were over.
Dick Stanton and Geoffrey Rolfe both remember the contributions made by their fathers to the war effort.
But my father also, he was involved in Home Guard, and I suppose you can call it Dad's Army. But he used to go off every weekend, and so, several of the chaps at the farm and his team, and they used to do exercises. They used to go and blow up, you could blow up, had a lot of explosives. And they also had a little cabin about 40 foot down the Samian Woods. I have been taking that, I couldn't find it again. Apparently, I don't really believe the story, but the only way you knew it was underground was there was a rhododendron bush planted above it, which flowered on Christmas Day.
And there was also another thing I did mention, is the Home Guard. My father was in the Home Guard, my grandfather was in the RAP, as an earache warden, and he would go out note times and make sure people hadn't got lights shining.
Yes, because you weren't allowed to show a chink, were you?
No, you had a bicycle light with only a little tiny slit through metal.
Yeah.
Car lights were the same. These are some of the things that stick out in my mind as a young child. And then going down, like, down the hill, you would very often have one of the home guard and that jump out on you, and who goes there? Friend or foe sort of effort.
Yeah, is that what you used to have to say?
No, they would ask you that.
Yeah, who goes there, friend or foe?
Because we used to go down to George King the barber's and sit in his hut. That was warm. We'd very often sit in there for night time. And of course that'd be dark when you come back, and then
and you'd be groping around trying to find your way.
They'd want to know who you was.
Yes. Because presumably they assumed that there could be Germans who'd come in off the coast.
Well, I think they was always aware of that, weren't they? What was going on, and so they just find out who you are for all that you as children.
While many villagers joined the forces and served overseas, those who contributed to the war effort at home and those who were children remember, like Dick Stanton, the arrival of the soldiers in the village.
Then the troops arrived. My mother was in charge of the WVS. She was in charge of the billeting in the area. And so we had a lot of troops who came through. They came here, they came to the house. A lot of them lived in the old hall, where they had a canteen in the old hall. I can remember one or two of the troops, but there were so many of them.
What were they actually defending? What area here? Was it just general? Or?
They were just billeted here. They were passing through, in transit.
Right, on their way to?
Well, look, I can remember a lot of Newfoundlanders who came, who went to Dieppe.
Right.
And they had a really rough time at Dieppe. Dieppe raid, and we had then really troops coming all the way through until after D-Day.
Now here is Jill Griffin, followed by Elizabeth Neal, recounting their memories of this.
When I was a little girl, I can remember we had to have soldiers billeted with us, and we had three.
And did you have room for them in your house?
Yes, they had to. We had a three-bedroom house, but they had to sleep in the front room, bedroom. I can always remember.
So three soldiers slept in one bedroom.
One of them taught me to ride a bicycle, and they used to teach me over the ploughing field, which was a lot of bushes, all on the ploughing field.
The big main ploughing field now.
Opposite,
Mr. Cross.
That's right. It used to be all bushes, so there was just a sort of track across to the other gate.
So there weren't any swings and
roundabouts? No, nothing. It was all little bushes.
Right.
And they taught me to ride a bicycle across there, and what always stuck in my mind, that none of them came back, and unfortunately they all got killed in the war.
Oh dear.
All of them got killed.
When the Americans came, that was another thing.
Oh, thing, yes.
You know, for the village. And they used to drive through, and we used to call out, "Got any gum?" And they'd throw the gum out of their lorries, you know.
So where were they on their way to the Air Force base?
Yes, Sculthorpe and those areas, I suppose, yes.
And they were very much the glamour figures, weren't they?
Oh, yes. And those teenage girls thought they were absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
And some of the lads were only a few years older than we were.
That was quite
funny. We had a strange coincidence. I mustn't keep on with the stories of the war, but one night we had a knock on the door. I can remember there was mother and the little evacuee girl and myself, and this gentleman, we opened the door, and he looked so sad and worn out, and he said, "Oh, can you tell me the way to Bertram?" My mother said, "Oh, it's a long walk from here to Bertram." She said, "Why do you want to go to Bertram?" He said, "Well, my son's in the Air Force and he's got himself into some kind of trouble and I must get to him." So mother said, "Oh, you can't go tonight," she said. "You better stay here for the night."
So he came in and he had something to eat with us, and he stayed the night, and in the morning we got up and he'd gone. And Mother looked round and thought, well, nothing's missing, and what's happened? We didn't think any more about it. He'd gone and that was it. And then we always had the day for doing the bedrooms, you know. It was very... Mother was very organised every day. You had certain jobs to do. Wednesday was bedroom day.
When the sheets were all changed.
That's right.
Because everybody had white cotton sheets.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the sheets and things had to be changed. And, of course, the mats had to be shook. And they were the little slip mats in the doorways of the bedrooms upstairs. And as she picked this mat up, there was a ten-shilling note underneath. And a little note saying, thank you very much for your help. And then, ever so many years later, must have been 15 years later, my father was out in the garden one day and he was digging, and this car drew up and a gentleman got out and said, could you tell me, does the lady who used to live here during the war still live here? And father said, oh yes, and it turned out to be this gentleman,
and
he could come back.
And he'd managed to walk
to Birchland. Yes, and he'd sorted his son out.
Good gracious.
Bernard Twight, who was only a little boy at the time, can still remember these events.
The earliest recollection would have been probably the latter end of the war, the sound of the planes going out or coming back.
Now, you were how old then?
I was born in 1939, so four, five.
Right.
The bombers from the airfields round about would be going out over the Wash and coming back. I can remember the army exercising in manoeuvres. The drift would disappear under smoke at times, smoke screens. I can remember convoys of army vehicles being parked along Lynn Road and all the houses providing tea and sandwiches for
where
the soldiers.
But where were they based?
Some would have been at the drill hall, and some what is now St George's.
So they actually lived there?
They were local, yes. We also had soldiers billeted with us during the war. They would... I'm not quite sure why, but some... quite a number of soldiers were in houses when they were about. They would go off and then they would come back, and again we kept in touch, and they were close friends, and then up till the time they died, up into the 50s and 60s, they did keep in touch.
Presumably it's the sort of strategic importance of the East Coast.
Probably, yes.
The Germans and everything.
Yes.
So you've got happy memories of the soldiers, but were your parents worried having all these soldiers here?
No, I think they were here and they finished up part of the families.
Here is Bill Playford again, as he has distinct memories of all these events.
Yeah, the Newfoundland boys were stationed here in the top school, you know, where you were.
Right.
Although, and that never was used as a school, do you see?
You mean it was built and
Freddie
then the
Shanks
war
built
came?
Built the war came, they commandeered straight away,
right.
You see? In fact, they had to put a new parquet floor in it because their boots absolutely ruined the floor. And
and you call them Newfoundlanders?
Newfoundlanders.
Right.
Yeah. They were and still are known by a number. And because each Christmas and birthday time, we ring up one of the girls who married one of the Newfoundlanders, and I said to Ernie Kelly, I said, that's a long while since we cooked the Christmas dinners for you, Ernie, because they brought about 20 turkeys down and Father and I cooked them in the ovens for them for their Christmas dinner.
So those boys were stuck in Dersingham, away from home.
In fact,
in
their cookhouse down this end was where the gateway to the Gamekeeper's Lodge is now. They were in there as well.
And did they actually have to go on active service?
Yeah, they did. They ended up in North Africa, most of them.
They had the tanks, didn't they? The tanks.
They had these terrific naval guns on rubber wheels, and they were at Wolferton, and we used to go Sunday mornings and sit up on the common, on the seats up there, and watch them fire them out to, into the wash, the targets. Down the wash, yeah, yeah.
And they practice. Were, I suppose, they were here in case the Germans came across.
Right. Well, they were just over here, you know, like the Americans came. They came first. I think it was the 57th or something they called themselves. And they still have a parade in Newfoundland. Well, that's Canada now, and
yes.
They've done that in Newfoundland. Every year, I don't know when it is, but they're getting old people now. Like most of the war people.
And did they mix all right?
Yes, yeah, they was all right, nice chaps. In fact, they used to help, didn't they, with the war weapons weeks when they had these war weapons weeks.
Right.
Yeah, they were. They were English officers down as far as the sergeant major, and then they were all Newfoundland boys.
I suppose our own local boys had gone off to serve. Mm,
most of them had, yes. Yeah. But that was just a case of getting them over here, I think. And then there was they went, and a load of Waltz and Matilda tanks came up the top school and into the gamekeeper's lodge. Of course, there was nothing else to do. We used to go for a walk around the village at night, and we looked up over that brick wall, which is now missing from the church hall back to Janet's corner, and there were these dozen Waltz and Matilda tanks sitting in there. And one Sunday morning, well, they flipped off overnight. Early in the morning they went down Post Office Road and they were gone somewhere and they just weren't here. But they took them up onto the common one day. That must have been on a Sunday. And us kids all went up with them to see what they were going to do. And they just ran about on the common. They parked one in front of our shop and swung it around. Father said, "You want to watch out, there's a big drain run under there." Oh, he said, "Don't worry about that." He said, "Any damage, he said, we'll compensate you for it." And they took them up on the top of the common. Then they went down onto the main road and back up Heathrow again. And now they've cleared that common. You can still see those ruts where those tanks went down.
Oh,
yeah.
Now,
the officer in charge, he was pointing about over there, going across onto the fen. I said, "You should take them over there, you'll lose them. They'll sink." Yeah. Because they didn't know where they were or what the land was like at all.
Standing on the corner of the crossroads in Dursingham is a small guest house. In the past, it has been known as the Temperance Hotel, later the West Dean Guest House, and now it has been recently reopened under new management and is now known as Ashdean House. During the war years, Mr. Fisher's father and mother ran it, and it was known then as the Chestnut Tree Guest House. There were soldiers billeted there, and the Fishers used to lay on tasty suppers for the men. Moreover, as it was one of the few houses in the area that had a bathroom, the military requisitioned it and sent soldiers from the Norfolk Regiment, who were billeted in the drill hall, down there each week to have a bath at sixpence a time. Mr. and Mrs. Fisher were also compensated with an extra ration of coal.
The children of the village found all this most exciting and were not perhaps fully aware of the hardships, particularly those associated with rationing. Here is Alan Cross.
I remember one instance when my mother had promised me something, if this was obviously during the war years, early war years, if I did so and so and so and so, and I did these things, and I was given an orange, and that was a treat to her. That was the best she could get at that time to give me.
Yes. So what's, I mean, during the wartime, what sort of diet did a young lad have? Can you remember?
In many ways, perhaps in the country, we may have benefited by some of the townsfolk, in as much that nearly everyone had allotments. We all had big gardens, and that was part of the thing that we had to do to help on the allotments and the gardens to grow various things, which meant that we had a good stock of vegetables and this kind of thing. Many places also kept chickens, and which obviously gave you some food from the eggs, and indeed when the chickens got old, from the chickens themselves. We used to have sport by catching rabbits, although at the time we didn't really appreciate it as youngsters. We had our enjoyment from trying to catch these rabbits, but they were in fact a basic diet, and from this point of view in some ways, we food wise, we perhaps didn't do too badly, but vegetables and what you produced yourselves was one of the main things.
So it sounded really as if it was a very healthy diet.
It probably was. In terms of what we have today, it was a healthy diet. Everything was natural that you had. There was very little tinned stuff at that time. Obviously, one, that was early days of tinned foods, and two, they simply weren't available.
And milk, of course.
Milk was plentiful. There was never a problem with milk. Local delivery people, or indeed the farmers themselves, had their own milk runs then.
During the war, to help with more efficient food production, a pumping station was erected to drain the Dersingham marshes, which were then ploughed and existing fields squared up. The concrete road to the beach was constructed, and shingle from the shingle banks was taken to the airfield at Marham. Peter Reynolds speaks about this.
Because that was all changed during that marsh. The layout of the marsh was changed at the early part of the war, when people called the War Agricultural Executive, a government body, had it drained and squared up. Instead of odd-shaped bits, it became rectilinear, that sort of thing. Mm. Pumping station put in to drain the water away. Mm-hmm. And a lot was planted up, of course, for food production.
Yes.
The grazing became diminished. I wouldn't say ceased, it diminished. Mm. And then during the war, the whole area, all that shingle bank, when there were shingle banks there 20 feet high above the general level.
Yeah.
And it was all taken, as I said, most of it finished up in places like the base of the runways at Marham Airfield. Lorries were running constantly to and fro, taking it up as base for concrete.
Did the lorries
go? After the war, it was worked out that the work was stopped because of fear of flooding, that the shingle bank was so weak that the sea might come in.
Yeah.
As indeed it did in 1953.
As the war progressed, many villagers remembered seeing the prisoners of war who worked farms in the area. There was a prisoner of war camp at Snettisham.
Let's listen to Sidney Mitchell and Ivy Lines talking about this.
I can recall prisoners of war. They were German prisoners of war, and they could be identified because they had patches sewn on their, what was left of their uniforms, red patches on their backs.
Really? So that if they escaped?
So if they escaped, they would be easily recognisable. And they were employed by the local shepherd, Mr. Lincoln, who lived in Chapel Road, and tended all the stock on what was then the marshes that was between the railway line and the Wash.
And that would be the royal cattle?
No.
It? Oh, not no. The royal cattle.
They were the land, for the most part, or marshes as we knew them, were owned by the local farmers. And the local farmers would graze their stock, cattle, sheep and horses, on these marshes. And Mr. Lincoln was designated the marsh shepherd and tended the flock or the animals on a contractual basis for the various farmers. And I remember distinctly him going off to the marshes in the morning in his horse and cart, with the German prisoners marching behind.
Where were the prisoners actually living?
I don't exactly know where they were billeted, but I do know where Mr. Lincoln lived. And whether they were billeted in accommodation behind his house,
yes,
in Chapel Road, I know not.
No.
There weren't many of them. There were sort of a group of five or six.
Here they had the prisoners of war on the farms, and it was before the end of the war, actually. I can remember walking down Dodds Hill on my own. I was young. And up the hill towards me was coming all hulled of Germans. Now, I knew they were Germans, and I was terrified. Absolutely terrified. And when I got nearer them, I was going to run back, and I didn't. They swabbed, and they said, how far are the Russians off Berlin? In English, to ask me, you hear the news, you listen to the news, in broken English, they were talking.
Right.
And I said, I don't know how far the Russians are from Berlin, but I think they're all there, you know. I think that...
You only knew what you'd heard from the news?
Yeah. They were all... That was hand-to-hand fighting in Berlin. But he said, the Russians! They want to know about the Russians.
Yeah.
I didn't know how far the Russians were, but... I said, Germany, I think, has lost the war. I said, let me get by. And I pushed my way out to walk down the hill. Because I met them right on the hill.
Yeah.
They were coming up here to the farm. But that was the only time they were held prisoner behind barbed wire, and that was spools.
Yes.
Before that. They didn't work on the farm before that.
Right. And then they...
You know, then they knew that they'd lost the war, so they let them come up there and work.
Until they were presumably sent back to...
Until they were... They were here for quite a long while, the prisoners.
Now,
and I also, another thing about the war, I can remember seeing smoke down there, because over the wash, because we've got a good view of the wash.
You have,
here,
yes.
In my garden.
Yes, you have.
Through binoculars, I can see the waves there of the water. Smoke, terrific lot of smoke, because down there was a station. Was American Air Force. American,
right, yes.
Planes were there.
Yes.
When they went, they put the German prisoners there, station. And I saw this terrific smoke. Well, I ran upstairs, looked out the bedroom window and watched it. And it was terrific. And then all of a sudden it exploded and went on. There was a plane.
Oh,
they'd
dear.
Come back as far as... But they had got the... Well, I was ever so worried about what
happened. Yes, because you didn't know.
And they had got the pilot out. They had got him out.
Oh, so he lived.
So he lived,
oh,
yeah.
God. Elizabeth Neal can recall what happened to these prisoners at the end of the war.
They had a prisoner of war camp down at Snettisham Beach. And after the war, there were lots of... They called them DPs, which was an awful name, really. They were displaced persons from all over Europe, and these poor things who had lost their families from Poland and Germany and all over, and they were put in this camp, which had been the prisoner of war camp. And my father and I used to go down and deliver bread.
And this was
there.
Where? Down at Snettisham?
Down at Snettisham Beach,
yeah.
Yes. And I can remember the awful smell of this awful stew stuff they used to have. I suppose it was stew. As they
yes.
make it. And we used to deliver the bread, and then the baker who was there then, he was very good, and any cakes that hadn't been sold or any bread and things that you were not allowed to sell the following day would be taken down there, and we used to go down with the old van and deliver it to these people. And they were so sad and so badly dressed, and you know, people in the village helped as best they could, but no one had very much, you know, after the war. You still rationed with clothes
yes,
and things,
so
but it was
them.
So sad.
And were they old people or young people?
No, they were a mixture, a cross section of people, really, who just, some had run away from the army, and some just didn't know what had happened to their families, some had their families dragged off to concentration camps and things, and they didn't know what happened to them.
So you must have heard some pretty pitiful stories.
Oh, it was, yes. And I was only about 12, 13. And,
yes.
and that, oh, you know, it seemed
sex.
So very, very sad.
How long did they stay there? Can you remember?
I can't remember that. It must have been 2 or 3 years, I think. And some did settle and married local girls and stayed in the area.
During this time, when the village was full of soldiers, many of the villagers joined together to raise funds for the war effort. The dances and concert parties that took place are well remembered.
And here is Nora Nurse, who took part in many of these concerts.
Of course, Mrs Reg Hoachin, I'll say give her a name because there were several Hoachins. Mrs Reg Hoachin, she was quite good at putting things on like that. And she asked several people if they'd... I don't know whether anyone had asked her if she'd do anything, but she invited several people to a meeting to see whether they could do something for War Weapons Week in the first place, War Weapons Week. And so we went to a meeting, I was interested, and we had a meeting, and we got together, you know, and we had met and we had these rehearsals, and we put this on, and she called it the Dursingham Premiers, because that's the first, you know, that was the first concert party they had. And we really had fun, and we had good times, we had hard work, because we used to practice, and they really did. I mean, the girls, because I was older than the girls then, I mean, I was married, and I'd got a baby at the time. My husband used to stay to look after my daughter while I went out. And we used to go all around to different villages and do these concerts for war weapons. That was what it was for. The villagers were, you know, raising
money. How did you get all the stuff?
Oh, well, which stuff?
All the costumes and things back round the villages. Did you have a...
We made them.
No, but I mean, did you go in cars?
Oh, no, Mr. Hoachin was a bus proprietor, you see.
Right.
So he had a bus. He only had the one bus when he first started. So we used to have his bus.
Right, because
you see, she was the organ. He went round, and he helped. He was great. He had great help. And his sister-in-law, Mrs. Evelyn Hoachin, she was a pianist. She was a pianist. And yes, we used to go around in the bus to different places and take used to carry cases. I've been coming down this road, of course it's not like it is now, because that was only lane. I've been coming down there 1 o'clock in the morning coming home from a concert.
1944 was the year of the D-Day landings. As June approached, the woods surrounding Dursingham were filled with tanks and lorries parked deep under the trees.
Ivy Lines told me all about this when I interviewed her.
I remember all the soldiers being there, and the wood here full of tanks. They prepared for D-Day. I can see that all in my mind now. All the tanks underneath all these trees. The woods were full of tanks and lorries.
Now that's the woods behind...
Hallway, yeah. And all off that road, you know, Admiral's Drive, the lorries and tanks were hid up underneath those trees, pushed right to the side. And they had taps down there which they used to clean them and whatnot, but they were hid from the air.
Yes.
So they were not seen.
So when they flew over.
Yeah. They were hid up in the trees. Terrific. And I always, my mother used to be ever so worried about an invasion and
in case they bombed them,
and I used to say, well, they're all hid up in there, absolutely hid up, and with all these troops here, you know, we feel safe, but we were not really safe, were we?
Well, did the troops used to come out and mix with the local?
They came out and mixed with, and there was also troops in houses up here, you know, billeted, because there were so many. Anybody who had a spare room had the troops billeted in. All sorts of things. They made us a lovely swing in the woods with rope. And I can remember going right over. They used to swing us nearly like Tarzans.
Because presumably when they weren't actually working, they used to come out.
Yeah, well, they used to be up there, woods. Yeah, they used to be up there with these... seeing after these lorries, and we used to call them big old lorries scammels.
So, as you were a child then, I mean, did you realise what it was all about?
Well, we didn't really. We didn't know nothing about the Holocaust and all that business of the war and the horrificness of it, but we did know that, that my father, we used to be able to quiet while the news was on, you know, and I used to hear Churchill and all his, anybody important who used to speak. My father was a fanatic for the news.
Yes.
That we had to keep quiet and listen to it. So we knew a little of what was going on.
Yes.
And I knew the different, I always remember hearing the different news read by Alvar Dell, and we also used to listen on the radio to William Joyce, that Lord Haw-Haw, who used, yes. And I can remember his, and the woman here hadn't got a radio, so she used to come round here to always listen to that. Always had to listen to William Joyce, Lord Haw-Haw,
yes.
We called him. And I remember him saying once that the clock at, he described it in his speech, and that was a Gatewood clock.
Really?
Yeah, we thought it was. Mrs. Asker and my mother were absolutely sure that he was describing. I wonder if he was some relation to the Joyces, because there was Dick Joyce lived here, wasn't there?
Yes.
And there was his sister married Hancock, the farmer here. Now, I don't know whether he was any relation. He was a traitor. Well, he was English.
That's right, yes. So, yeah. When the war ended, I mean, can you remember celebrating?
Oh, that's the only time up here that we really did celebrate. We put all the flags all out, and we put them from our land and window to that, right across the garden to that land and window, you know.
Right.
And we wrote all on the road in paint. I remember, "Welcome home to the prisoners," and on the gates. Yeah, really celebrating. They had
a sort of party.
And they went, yes, and they went. It was a big party all in Dursingham.
Was there? Whereabouts? Yeah,
all. Well, they all paraded, and we had dancers, and I went to them at night time. They had big parades and fancy dress. I can remember. I can remember the cool lorry being stuck in the middle of the parade. Yeah.
But you must have missed the soldiers. Because it must have seemed very
quiet. I can vividly remember D-Day. I was at my grandmother's, and my grandmother lived at Ypres. And we were coming back, my mother and my sister, and we walked from Ypres to Munford, which is a long way. Because that was all the battle area. It still is, isn't it?
Yes.
All round there.
Yeah.
And there was a terrific amount of troops there. All army convoys and convoys, you'd see. Well, we didn't see one, and then all of a sudden we saw the sky black with planes.
Were getting ready to fly.
Well, they were all flying out,
right?
And we were ever so frightened. Yeah. I said we better get into the hedge. Mum said, "They're not. There are planes. Oh, I said, "Whoever's going to face that lot?" And they went over, and that's about a 2.5 mile walk from my grandmother's to my sister who lived in Munford. And I can remember thinking. My mother kept saying, "There's something happening today." She kept saying, "I don't know what," but then I said, "Well, there was nothing on the road."
No, it
the
was
roads were still.
Well, had it? I mean, did anybody know it was D-Day then?
No.
It was a sort of secret.
No, until we got home and we had the radio on at night. There'd been an invasion in that. Nobody knew that was on.
It was all secrets.
It was all secrets.
That's why they called
it. Until we got home that night, and because we told. He said, "Yeah, that my dad, my father was still here. He didn't come. My mother, that we were with, and they've had an invasion." Oh, I said, "Fancy facing that lot," because you couldn't. It was so frightening.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The blackness of that sky, whereas we'd been used to all the roads, and there was nothing on the road. All these And then when we got home, here we went up the woods, all the tanks had gone from there.
And they never came back?
No, they never came back.
No,
but there was a lot of soldiers up here which didn't return. And they had a Canadians as well. And down the old hall, where the old hall is, there's a big wall along there. That was all tents in there, and that was all the Newfoundland regiment in there, living in tents. But there were soldiers everywhere. Up on Stanton, all troops. And I can remember going to Hunstanton, and the black mines, the spikes on the water, they were all mined, the whole beach was mined.
As Ivy has recalled, the end of the war was celebrated in style, as remembered by Dick Stanton.
I think it was VJ Day.
Right, tell me what you can remember about that.
Going round Dursingham, collecting any wood, anything would burn, anywhere. I went round with one of our drivers, who sadly no longer with us, called Dick Griggs, and we collected anything which would burn. I think it was August. And we went up to the hill behind you. We called it a hill in Norfolk, but it was quite a hill when you get on top there. And we had a bonfire that night. And I can't remember a lot about the bonfire, except there were a lot of people there.
So it was a bonfire for the village?
Bonfire for everybody in the village. And all I can remember, a silly thing, is there were two girls, there were a lot of, well, some old Home Guard thunder flashes around. I don't know where they got them from. Two went off and quite badly burned two girls.
Oh dear.
But it was, I think, a general sense of relief.
When I interviewed Elizabeth Neal, I asked her what was the most important day she had ever spent in the village. Her reply is a fitting way to end our story.
Oh, I think the day my father came home, as far as I was concerned, was the best day, apart from marriage, of course, but one of the happiest days, shall we say, was when my father came home.
And presumably these fathers came home at different times?
Yes.
So there wasn't a day?
No, because some were fighting in Europe, and some were in the Far East. My father was in the Far East. Some were prisoners of war who came home in dribs and drabs, really.
Yes.
But my father had malaria very badly and kidney problems. So he actually arrived home in England, but then he had to go into a fever hospital before he could come home because he was so weak. But he made it in just before VJ Day.
Now, can you remember the village celebrating the end?
No, that was something we were talking about, that we had a concert. I can remember a VJ concert. But well, it must have been several weeks after VJ Day, really, because it had to be organised. And I have got a photograph there of the concert that we did for VJ Day. But there were great celebrations in the village.
Do you think the children really understood how important it was? Or do you think children were just enjoying being, you know...
I think it was a mixture. I think those who'd had dads away at the war, I think that did it. It meant more to them, perhaps.
Yes.
But we didn't really understand about the war, I don't think. There was no television, you see. You heard was we would always have to sit and listen to the 6 o'clock news. But it didn't really mean very much as a child, you know. Looking back. And as I say, I could never remember feeling really frightened